Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, in for Randall White. Earlier this year, Cap Radio teamed up with Valley Vision to conduct a survey among residents in Stockton. Over the past couple of months, Cap Radio and Valley Vision again conducted a survey that reached out to residents in the greater Sacramento area. The survey touched on the hardships people have been facing due to the pandemic. Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan joins us this morning to help us break down what the survey results were in terms of food insecurity in the area. So, Sarah, what did some of the survey results show this time as compared to last time?
Sure. So results showed an increase in food insecurity for African-American and Latinx respondents in particular, despite an overall slight decline in food insecurity on average, which is interesting. About 30% of Latinx respondents and 36% of Black respondents currently say they cannot afford food. This as compared with 23% of African Americans who reported not being able to afford food back in May when our first survey was done. Also, on average, only 19% of respondents said they currently can't afford food. So you can kind of see where the pain in this category is really being felt. Blake Young, he's the president of the Sacramento Food Bank, says they're now serving double the amount of people they were serving pre-pandemic. He says they've noticed a few unfortunate trends when it comes to food insecurity.
It's not uncommon for parents to not eat so their children can. Another common trend is seniors, and we have a lot of seniors in this community that we're serving. They will definitely forego food to buy medicine. And so those two things. The other trend that we hear a lot is children are home. And children being home, as most of us know who have kids, they eat more. And, you know, it is very difficult to keep up.
What else did the survey show?
It also showed a slight increase in concerns about housing security for African Americans. On average, about 25% of respondents said they couldn't afford rent recently. But nearly half of African American respondents and a third of Latinx respondents said they couldn't afford rent. So you can see that this group is well above the average in these two categories or in this category. And we also saw a dramatic increase in African Americans' ability to purchase extras. So this was a question that asked people, how likely was it that you were able to purchase things like gifts or things for entertainment since the pandemic began? This is where I think we really see some sort of dramatic shift, just because in particular, 60% of Black respondents said they weren't able to afford extras in our most recent survey, but this was compared to just 40% of African Americans who reported this back in May. You can see there's been a significant jump, as I think a lot of people, particularly within the African American group and the Latinx group, are really feeling very squeezed, I think, is what this shows financially.
So in the big picture, what has this meant for Sacramento communities?
People like Monica Ruelas-Maris, she's a Latina organizer in South Sacramento, says the Latinx community feels really frustrated in the past 7 months. And especially now that we are entering the seventh month of the pandemic, she says many in the Latinx community where she lives are part of mixed status families, many of whom did not qualify for federal stimulus money or unemployment benefits. Here she is.
There are people who are disillusioned with a system that, like, did not support them when they needed it. Like, they felt like, well, we can't, they were hearing about all this federal stimulus funding, but, like, nobody was really receiving it, given their mixed status families.
She says a lot of members of the Latinx community where she lives are in some ways second guessing their decision to immigrate.
Because, you know, I think a lot of them recognize, like, yes, this is the country that I decided to come to. And, like, I am going to have to work hard to make a life for me and make a life for my family here. But it's never, I don't think anybody ever has the idea of, like, it being this hard or struggling this much just to get food on the table or resources or a job.
She says a lot of her neighbors are in what she said is survival mode, and that the pandemic has brought two things. Here she is again.
Like, I would see a lot of my community and, like, extended family members as well, like, you know, selling their cars. Like, they just need to, like, sell them. Even though they would, you know, rather keep them, they would sell them because they're like, I just need money now. you know, other people who have the means, like, would be able to purchase it, sell their cars, sell their possessions, sell things that they would have kept if the need wasn't so high to just have income right then and there.
But on a positive note, she also said that the pandemic has really helped to connect a lot of people in need to nonprofits in a way that the community may not have been connected before. And so in that way, she thinks this has been a positive thing.
And so what does this mean for the future? Is there a feeling that this will let up once the pandemic is over?
Unfortunately, no. Even the Sacramento Food Bank is preparing for a prolonged period of a lot of people being food insecure. And experts worry that the financial stress the pandemic has put primarily on African Americans and the Latinx community will have really long-lasting impacts on their ability to create generational wealth. Here's Cecia Aquino of the Latino Coalition for Healthy California.
In terms of, you know, having the ability to build wealth as a family and, you know, as a population, the Latino community do have an uphill battle with that. And so when we're talking about not being able to make the rent, not being able to put food on the table, then, you know, the thought of even affording a home just it's just out of the question.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this really hits at like a very important intersection here, which is that, I mean, overall, I think as we've heard again and again during the pandemic, COVID-19 has exacerbated inequities that we had in place in this country beforehand. And I think so naturally, I think it is the natural next step to see that, okay, experts are really concerned that we are now going to see that families who are already on the bottom end of this income gap or this equity gap, they are really going to see that gap widen post-pandemic. You know, Cecia mentioned that, yeah, if you're a family who has just been struggling to make rent, just been struggling to put food on the table, been struggling to keep employment during this 7-month period, you are likely not going to be primed to be able to buy a house next year or potentially anytime in the future. And maybe before the pandemic, you were a little closer to that. And, you know, as she mentions, this is just the building of generational wealth where if you have a house, you can afford to invest more. You at least have a bit of a nest egg there that you might be able to put into your children's education. And I think the pandemic just points to the fact that a lot of people, particularly African Americans and Latinx people, they're just not going to be able to do this. And the pandemic is, the longer the pandemic goes on, the further and further those prospects go out, if that makes any sense.
Sure. So, Sarah, where are you going from here? What are you working on next?
Sure. Yeah. I think we have also been looking at the Valley Vision Survey, and we can kind of hear some tones of this here, is the Valley Vision Survey really pointed out the fact that a lot of people are feeling disillusioned 7 months into the pandemic. Our first survey showed that people initially did have a lot of trust and felt that local government was doing a very good job with handling the pandemic. Interestingly, I think people have always felt some level of disillusionment with how the federal government was responding, but people initially did feel that both news outlets, interestingly, and local government efforts were doing a good job handling the pandemic. And that has actually shifted. When we came back around and did our survey this time, the survey results were taken in August, and it shows just higher levels of dissatisfaction with local government response, honestly, with media response to the pandemic. And I think that these are all just symptoms of this stretching out past half a year, past, you know, what many people thought would be just a few months of an uncomfortable lifestyle. So.
All right, Sarah, well, we will look forward to future updates. That is CAP Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan joining us to talk about food insecurity in the greater Sacramento area and also giving us some information about where she's headed for more reports down the road just a little bit. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
Yes, absolutely. Up next, we're going to talk to the Chancellor-Elect of the California State University System. He takes over in January and has a big job ahead of him. His priorities, the challenges of COVID, and how he thinks CSU will emerge from the COVID pandemic next. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, in for Randall White. The California State University System is the largest public university system in the country, with 23 campuses, including our very own Sac State University. And starting January 4th, CSU will have a new chancellor, Dr. Joseph Castro. Castro has been the president of CSU Fresno since 2013 and is the first Californian and Mexican-American to lead the CSU system. Dr. Castro takes the helm of CSU with a student body of over 480,000 students and 50,000 faculty and staff. And the student body is very diverse as well, with 43% Latino, followed by 22% whites, 15% Asians, and 4% African American, with all or most of them entering this school year during a global pandemic, forcing students and faculty online during the COVID crisis. Chancellor-elect Joseph Castro joins me now to talk about his new role and the challenges that await him. Dr. Castro, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Beth.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about your background, where you were born and grew up, and why this new role and the position you'll be coming into is so important, and what it means to you as the incoming chancellor of the California State University System.
Well, this is a very meaningful leadership opportunity, especially during a consequential time like today. I'm originally from the San Joaquin Valley, where I serve now as president of Fresno State. I was born in Hanford, just south of Fresno, about 35 miles. And my grandparents immigrated here from Mexico. My great-grandfather helped to build the railroad through the San Joaquin Valley. And he brought his wife, my great-grandmother, and my grandfather, who later helped to raise me. He came as a child, and they lived in tents along the railroad and eventually found themselves in Hanford. They worked the land here throughout the valley and Central Coast. So I have agricultural roots. And it's just a very meaningful opportunity to be able to serve here in the San Joaquin Valley now. And then looking ahead to January, to serve all of California as the first Native Californian as chancellor.
So you've spent many years now as president of CSU Fresno. How is that experience going to inform how you bring leadership priorities to the chancellor of the whole system? Big job.
It is a big job. It's the largest public university system in the whole country. And I think my preparation here at Fresno State, and I served at in the UC system for 23 years, so about 30 years total in California higher education. I believe that prepares me well for this new challenge. I have strong relationships in the Capitol, in Washington, D.C., with the other presidents of the CSU, with the UC system, and the community colleges. So I think that I'll bring that knowledge and expertise to the position and build on Chancellor White's very strong leadership over the last 8 years.
You're taking over at a tough time. Obviously, none of us could have expected this. We are in the midst of COVID. What are your top priorities starting in January in dealing with COVID and the university system?
This is a very challenging time, and I've served here throughout COVID and have a good sense of the innovation that's occurred at all the campuses and the ways in which we've learned during this period of time. And I think that'll help me as we move into 2021. My hope is that we can find ourselves into a new normal by the summer or fall. The spring is going to look a lot like the fall. And so my highest priority, of course, is going to be to ensure the safety of our students, faculty, staff, and families. And we'll be guided by the experts in this area and make good decisions, as Chancellor White has done with all of us over the last several months. And then I want to continue our progress with Graduation Initiative 2025. We have some bold graduation rate goals, and I want us to meet those. We need to decrease the equity gaps that exist in our state between and among groups. And my hope is that we'll be able to do that by 2025, and then we'll set some bolder group goals for 2030 and beyond. I'd like to leverage technology in some new ways. I'd like to strengthen our relationships with elected officials and inspire them to invest more in the CSU over time. And I'd like to help to diversify our faculty to work with our system to do that. I'd like to see our faculty reflect the diversity of our students a little bit better over the coming years.
You mentioned technology, and I think all of us have our eyes on the fact that students in some cases, teachers in some cases, have become used to working online. And so post-pandemic, do you think we're going to hang on to this style of virtual teaching in some respects?
I do. I think we're headed to a new place. I'm actually excited about where we're heading without the stress of the pandemic. We've been very creative during this time. The CSU is probably the best value in the country for our students, and many of them are struggling financially with their families. And we've done, I think, a very good job of helping them through this period of time. And I do believe that we're going to find ourselves in a new place where it's going to be even better for our talented students, for those who may have had a difficult time coming to a physical place in a regular way. This offers them a new option. And then for our faculty and staff who might be taking care of an elder or a child, this gives them more flexibility. So I'd like to see us consider some new ways of teaching and learning and doing research in the coming years without the stresses of this pandemic.
Digging into tuition a little bit, in 2007-2008, it cost about $2,800 for undergrad tuition. That number has more than doubled since then. And given the pandemic-induced economic crisis, do you see the cost of tuition increasing or decreasing anytime soon?
I actually think that the chances are that it will remain roughly the same. The Board of Trustees do not support a tuition increase, and nor do I. So I don't see that on the near-term horizon. Some students have asked us to reduce tuition and fees. And the challenge with that, of course, is that we're still paying our very talented and passionate faculty and staff, and they're teaching and supporting students in a different way, but they're still here by and large. And we're using the fees to support that and support the facilities that our students will need when we return to campus. So I don't anticipate any significant changes. And actually, Beth, there have been very few changes to tuition over the last 7-8 years during Chancellor White's tenure. And my hope is that we can be even more aggressive around the other costs related to education. The basic needs, the housing and food and other emergency needs. I'd like to see us be even more aggressive in the coming years to address those barriers.
And on the same topic, how can we address students struggling with student debt? Is there any way that the system can help alleviate the student debt problem?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, is keeping our tuition and fees as reasonable as possible so that there's, a stability there. The second thing is to continue to raise more public and private money for financial aid so that that reduces the out-of-pocket costs, especially for low-income students and middle-income students. Third, I would say even more financial management programs so that our students learn how to manage the money that they do have so they don't get themselves into debt. And I'd like to do everything I can to support that. And I think if we do those things together, we'll be able to keep our debt levels down And CSU has done a great job of that. And I'd like to see us continue to keep it as close to zero as possible.
And final question this morning, Chancellor Select. The California State University touts itself as the largest source of the state's skilled workforce. How do you see that role as the university system's priorities continue? Is it the main priority? Are you going to expand perhaps liberal arts or the CSUs as research institutions? Where are the priorities right now with that?
Well, as you might know, Beth, 1 out of 10 California employees is a CSU alumnus. So we already play a very powerful role in supporting this economy. And I see that continuing and even strengthening over time. And California needs a strong CSU and a strong public higher education system. So my hope is that we can continue to inspire the governor and the legislature to invest more so that our system can serve more students from all different backgrounds and help them to thrive. We've certainly seen that throughout the CSU and at Sac State, where the 4-year graduation rate has really skyrocketed during President Nelson's presidency.
Incoming CSU Chancellor Select Joseph Castro, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on CAP Radio today.
Thanks, Beth.
Let's hear now from Sac State's president, Dr. Robert S. Nelson. President Nelson, thank you for joining us. And as always, stingers up.
As always, stingers up. That's right.
First off, your reaction to incoming Chancellor's Joseph Castro's new position as the leader of the CSU system, and specifically, what does that mean for Sac State?
I am very proud to have the incoming Chancellor as a friend, as someone that I've gotten to know well over the last few years. The first sentence that he spoke when he spoke to us presidents about being the new chancellor, he identified himself as a Mexican American. That meant a lot. That meant that he honored his heritage and he was bringing something new, an insight that we need so much. 34% of our students are Latinx here. They need people that they can identify with. They need leaders that they can see. And Joe Castro is one of those leaders. He's going to come in with a lot of experience and with a big heart, and he's going to make a difference.
Do you have some top priorities that you'd like to work on with the new chancellor regarding our campus here?
We're working very hard with the graduation initiative still. We've gone from 8% 4-year graduation rate to 22.4%. We'll be up in the 30s shortly. So we want to continue moving in that direction. We want to continue with our retention rates. But we're also working very hard on being an anchor institution, an anchor university. We want to work with the community, and President Castro did that very well down at Fresno State, so I'm sure he'll be able to help us in that direction. And finally, we're working on becoming an anti-racist campus and making sure that we are inclusive and caring, and that's a very important initiative as we reach out and become a truly inclusive campus.
Let's talk a little bit about budget issues facing our university. You recently announced that Sac State has to cut about $9 million from its budget. Where's that money coming from?
Each division, and divisions are business affairs, student affairs, et cetera, each division cut its budget by 10%. We have a hiring freeze, and we're not hiring people right now. We have a travel freeze. We're not traveling and going anyplace. So we've had to decide that there are some things that we're not going to do. And we've made strategic cuts, but we've not sacrificed education at all. Instead, we've made sure that we've added additional courses so that students are going to be successful and can take as many courses as they need.
And so the economic outlook then moving forward is?
Rough.
Rough.
rough, but stable. Okay. We are in a position where we know where we're going. We have a balanced budget. We used $7 million from our reserves to make sure that it was a balanced budget. And we have an early exit program so that people can retire early, and that saves us money as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the elephant in the room, right? The COVID situation. Bring us up to date on how virtual learning is going for students, faculty, and staff.
It's going a lot better than I ever dreamed it would, okay? I'm sure there are rough spots out there, the rough spots in face-to-face teaching. But our faculty this summer, over 800 of them went to summer camp. They went back to improve their skills on teaching virtually. They went back to learn how to use new platforms, to learn how to record, to be able to teach synchronously and asynchronously. I think the real telling point was when March 17th, when we became virtual, we expected a lot of students to drop out. We expected them not to be able to succeed. The truth is that only 70 students dropped out. Normally, we'd have many more than that in that time period. So that means that we were successful, and we graduated 9,778 students this last year. So I'm proud of what the faculty are doing, and I'm proud of what the students are doing.
Are there any students living on campus at this time, or have all the dorms and housing been in, on campus been shut down?
There's about 350 people living on campus. They're individuals who, some of the students were homeless, and this is, we've opened up the campus for them. Some of them are athletes. Others are taking classes. We have about 300 to 400 students every hour taking classes where they need to be here because they need a certain piece of equipment in engineering to smash concrete, or they need instruments for music, and they need to be able to work with lighting in the theater, or they need to work with mannequins because they're nurses and they're doing their clinical rotations. So there are some students, but it's only 7.3% of the normal classes that we usually have.
Is that number going to remain about the same, do you think, as we head into the next semester?
Yes, we're just identifying the courses right now. It won't be a lot more than that. The faculty have been very resourceful and are able to stay virtual. We want to minimize the number of people on campus. We've been very successful as far as COVID cases, and we want to make sure that we remain successful.
So with students attending classes online, there's been some pushback regarding why tuition and student fees can't come down due to COVID-19. Can you explain why that can't change or be reduced, and what options do students have?
79% of my budget, of our budget, of Sac State's budget, goes for employees and for faculty and staff. That hasn't changed, and it won't change. So we need to be able to pay the faculty and staff. They are teaching, they are working, just like they've always worked. Now, some of them are working from home, but we still need advisors. We still need all of those people. So the overall cost of the university has actually increased as we've had to go virtual, as we've had to buy millions of dollars of computers for our students, over $800,000 just in hotspots for students so that they can hear and communicate using the internet. And then there's debt services that we're still paying. A lot of people think that the fees that we have, mandatory fees, are really fees for service. When you go to the well, that you're paying like you're going to a gym. No, that's not the case. What you're doing is you're paying for the debt service on the building. The students voted for the well many years ago so that they could have a facility like that. They voted for the student union. they voted for athletics, and those athletic fields still exist, and we're still paying the bonds, the mortgages on them. So I really can't reduce them because we have to pay your mortgage just like anybody else.
And speaking of athletics, you know, unfortunately, you had to announce that Sac State would opt out of the proposed 2021 Big Sky football season. I'm sure a big disappointment, but understandable. Can you explain, though, some of the factors behind the decision? And what about the impact on other sports and activities?
We made a very hard decision about football. It is COVID related, but it is not necessarily about the virus itself. Okay. We made a decision early on in the Big Sky to do spring football and not to do fall football because we didn't have the testing and we didn't have everything that we needed. Well, as we got closer and closer to the actual football, I listened to the coach. And what the coach told me that is if we play football in December and in we practice in December, start playing in January and play all the way into May, and then we start football again in the fall in August, there's not enough time between May and August for our athletes' bodies to heal, to be ready, to be in shape. So we made a decision based upon their health that we weren't going to play football. We will play it in the fall. We will have the testing and everything will be up and running on that front. We will be playing basketball in the meantime. They have not started practicing yet, but that should begin around November 25th. And we plan to have soccer in the spring and volleyball as well, and baseball, of course.
Any chance of any track and field coming back anytime soon? Some of the huge events that Sac State has hosted?
Yes, they will be coming back and we will have them. In fact, we will be hosting regional meets for the NCAA this coming year.
Kind of jump to a couple quick things here. You know, if you drive around the campus or walk around as I came into the studio today, there's lots of construction going on. What is going on? What's being worked on around the campus right now? It seems like there's a lot of projects.
Well, one of the major projects is the housing that is coming up. It's a P3, so it's a private-public partnership with Graystar, and that is housing that it was on the McAuliffe ball fields. It had started long before the COVID era happened, but it is the construction is taking place there. We're also expanding the health center, the well. We need more counseling rooms. We need more space for the doctors and the like so that we can fully service them. So those are the two large projects you're seeing. And then we are taking the advantage right now when there aren't that many people on campus to try to get rid of trip hazards on the walkways and everything. So there's a lot of places where tree roots have taken up the sidewalk and we're able to now go in and put concrete and smooth it all out for ADA purposes.
So the same question and final question for you today is the one I asked the incoming chancellor, Castro. Where do you see Sac State on the back end of the COVID crisis?
We'll be stronger than ever, okay? We will always be student-oriented and student-focused. Our graduation rates will continue to climb and grow. We will probably have more classes online than we had in the past. We've learned how to do things differently. We've learned how to do some things that are very exciting with video and the like. But I see us moving forward, continuing to grow, and continuing to serve Sacramento and the Sacramento region.
Sac State President Dr. Robert S. Nelson, we really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Beth.
Still ahead, the California, or make that the Affordable Care Act, faces its biggest legal challenge yet. What's at stake for millions of Californians as the ACA heads to the Supreme Court just days after the presidential election and the potential of a new justice on the bench? Shoot us an email at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, sitting in for Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the past decade, California has embraced the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, more vigorously than any other state. It's led to millions more people having health care and made insurance more affordable for many. But on November 10th, 5 days after the election, the Supreme Court will hear an argument that could overturn the landmark health law in its entirety. And a lot of that is contingent on whether Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett gets confirmed. Here to talk about the details and what it means for California is CAP Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Chiola. Good morning, Sammy.
Hi, Beth. Good morning.
Let's start with the court case. What's it about?
So, as you said, it is about the Affordable Care Act. Some people might know it as Obamacare. And this case came to be back in 2018-2019. And basically, Texas led 20 states in suing the federal government. And here was their argument. In 2017, the Trump administration zeroed out what we call the individual mandate penalty. So basically, there's a federal requirement that you carry health insurance. And it used to be that if you didn't carry health insurance, you had to pay a fine to the federal government. When President Trump entered office, one of the earlier things he did was eliminate the penalty. So there's still a requirement, but you don't have to pay a fine anymore. And Texas and the other plaintiffs in this case say, well, the individual mandate is unconstitutional because that penalty has been zeroed out. And so the whole Affordable Care Act cannot stand. That's basically the legal argument that they are trying to make. California Attorney General Javier Becerra has interceded in this case. He's leading the defense. There are 21 states trying to stand up for the ACA to say that argument doesn't make sense to us. We don't see why just because there's no fine that the whole act should come down. In the lower courts, the federal government did argue that, you could nix the individual mandate, but you don't have to nix the whole thing. You should be able to sort of parse out what has legal standing and what doesn't. But the Supreme Court would have to send that down to a lower court for them to make that determination. But so where it is right now is November 10th, the Supreme Court is going to hear it, and they could very well make the decision to just overturn it in its entirety and say, no more Affordable Care Act. So Javier Becerra is pretty fired up about this. He talked about it at a recent press conference.
Recognize that we've got a job ahead of us. The most immediate one is about 3 weeks away. But we've got a job ahead of us because we got to make sure that no one takes our health care.
So what has...
Hey, sorry about my my dog.
That's okay. I have a couple of dogs at home myself.
I just want to add that this is not a new pattern. We have been seeing Republicans trying to take down the Affordable Care Act for years, essentially since it came into being in 2010. There have been tries after tries to either take it down entirely or reduce how comprehensive it is. So this is just sort of the next iteration of that.
So what has the ACA actually done here in California? Do we have kind of a general opinion of it in the state?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say we're pretty pro Obamacare here in California. Healthcare advocates, especially those that try to connect low-income folks to insurance, have really embraced the act. So in 2012, California had 6.5 million people who were uninsured. In 2017, we had just 3.5 million. So essentially, we enrolled 3 million people. Those were largely low-income people, largely people from communities of color. And we were able to do that because of what you might know as the Affordable Care Act expansion, which basically made lots of people eligible for Medi-Cal who were not eligible before. That includes people with pre-existing conditions, right? So if the ACA goes away, they wouldn't necessarily be covered anymore. People who are on their parents' insurance until they're up to age 26, that was something that the Affordable Care Act made possible. And the act also created what we call exchanges or the individual market. Here it's called Covered California. It's basically a public insurance market where if you don't get insurance from your employer and you're not eligible for Medi-Cal, you can go there and shop around for plans. And thanks to the Affordable Care Act, your monthly premiums you pay on those plans are subsidized by the federal government. And here in California, they're also subsidized by the state government. But those federal subsidies are really what make people able to afford to buy through Covered California, because without them, the monthly premiums can be really high. And so because California got so excited about the Affordable Care Act and enrolled so many people, we get a lot of money from the federal government to sustain it. So the federal government pays to keep people on Medi-Cal, and they also give those subsidies to make insurance cheaper. And if the act is overturned, California could actually lose out on $28 billion, $20 billion of that for Medi-Cal, about $8 billion for Covered California. So you might imagine that health advocates are really up in arms about this case. This is a bite from Anthony Wright. He is with Consumer Group Health Access.
As we took advantage to gain the most from the Affordable Care Act, we in California have the most to lose from the Affordable Care Act being struck down.
So, you know, we're hearing a lot of concern from health advocates. You know, I was at a town hall the other day, a virtual town hall, where so many different groups spoke up to say, we need the Affordable Care Act. We had LGBTQ representatives talking about gender-based care, transition care that the Affordable Care Act covers, that, you know, if those people were taken off Medi-Cal, they may not be able to get the gender-affirming care that they need. We had representatives from Planned Parenthood talking about the protections that the Affordable Care Act puts in for pregnant people, for children, for people who need contraception, for people who need preventive women's health screenings. And, you know, we also heard a lot from the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network, who said, you know, the number of Asian American Californians and Black Californians who were uninsured was about halved during this expansion of the Affordable Care Act. So that's huge. That's major gains in communities of color. And there were also big gains in the Latinx community, though a little bit less so because people who are not documented are prohibited from enrolling in Medi-Cal. So they weren't able to access the ACA in the same way. But in the last few years in California, we have seen a really big push to make undocumented Californians eligible. And we actually now have Medi-Cal eligibility for undocumented children up to age 18, and also undocumented young adults up to age 26. So even today, we're still really pushing people to sign up.
So much hanging in the balance with this, yet we really don't know what's going to happen. People are predicting what's going to happen. A lot of legal experts certainly have predictions about Amy Coney Barrett. What do you think is kind of the pulse in terms of what experts are predicting, Sammy?
It's interesting. People in healthcare circles were already really, really worried about this case. I mean, I've been hearing about this case for 2 years as it sort of snaked its way through the lower court. And at first, people didn't seem to be taking it that seriously. Oh, it's not, you know, it may not go anywhere. We don't think it's a very strong argument. But in the last couple of weeks, people have been on edge about it. And I think the idea is that, you know, Amy Coney Barrett has had a history of making comments about, you know, dismantling or weakening the Affordable Care Act. Some of the legal arguments she's made on healthcare in general indicate that she would probably most likely vote to strike it down. And I mean, this is just what I've heard from healthcare experts who have been following her statements and who have been following the case. So, you know, it's certainly a tense time. So they are going to hear the argument on November 10th, and they don't need to make a decision until June 2021. So it's not like, you know, if they, they're going to strike it down immediately.
Yeah, it's not instantaneous shutdown or something.
So it is going to be still a continued long narrative. But, you know, in California, there are things that we can do to try to keep our system intact. So, you know, the federal government can change eligibility for Medicaid on a federal level, but it's still up to states to decide who remains eligible. So if Governor Gavin Newsom says, hey, look, everybody who is eligible for Medi-Cal right now, you're going to stay on Medi-Cal. Like, we're not going to kick you off your plans. He has the power to do that, but the state would have to backfill all of the federal funding that used to support those people and their plans. And, you know, some of the economists that I've spoken to said, that's going to be really hard. That's like $20 billion. We don't know where we're going to get that. So it might be that, you know, lawmakers have to think about, well, maybe we keep this group on, but we take this group off. You know, there would be a lot of deliberations. We are already doing some state subsidies for covered California. And I'd imagine, you know, we would want to do more of those to try to take the place of any federal subsidies that are going to disappear. We also have in California our own individual mandate. So our own state requirement that you carry insurance. And that's a relatively new development. Governor Gavin Newsom spearheaded that. It was pretty controversial. And it's basically based off your insurance status for 2020. So if you were uninsured for more than 3 months in 2020, you are going to pay a fine to the state of California. And those fines actually generate the subsidies that we give to people on covered California. So it's sort of a revenue generator to try to make care more affordable. But a lot of people have criticized it because, you know, if you're struggling financially, you may not be able to buy health insurance, and then you're going to have to, you know, pay a penalty for not buying health insurance. And that would certainly be something that they would want to look at if people are getting taken off of Medi-Cal or people are being priced out of covered California. Lawmakers may say, well, then maybe we shouldn't fine them for not having insurance. But, you know, that is all so far ahead. It's hard to even guess. But I mean, I imagine the fate of the Supreme Court case really is going to depend a lot on Amy Coney Barrett's nomination. And then even after that, it's hard to say which way the vote will go. And I do think it'll take several months. And but I do know, I was just going to say, here in California, I think, you know, Attorney General Javier Becerra is a very, very strong advocate for the Affordable Care Act. And having heard him speak about it quite recently, I think he will give it his all in fighting for this statute in court.
Sure. And the other thing to throw into the ringer is we don't know what the federal government might do. If it is struck down, there are certainly emergency actions that could be taken by the new administration. And that's like a whole big question mark. What will happen?
Yeah, so I'm sorry that I wasn't able to be a better, you know, fortune teller here.
Yes.
But hopefully I've given people some of the background so they at least know what's going on when this hits the courts on November 10th.
Yeah, well, lots ahead here in the next week, and we appreciate you detailing all of this for us. That is CAP Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Keola. Sammy, thanks for being on Insight.
Thanks, Beth.
Well, you can find out more about any of the guests you heard from today here on Insight at capradio.org/insight. That is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Randall White. Our producers are Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. Thank you for joining us this morning on Insight. I'm Beth Duncan in for Randall White.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.